We're going to be in Revelation 12 today. We're going to be in Revelation 12. If you're joining us for the first time, you came in at a good spot. Seriously, you did. Revelation 12, we're about halfway done with Revelation. We've got about 8 more weeks, including today, to get done with it. Have you ever been watching a movie? Probably so. But have you ever been watching a movie? You're like following the main characters, like following the story. And then all of a sudden, like in the blink of an eye, all of a sudden the movie's different. Like what was up on the screen for most of the movie has changed all of a sudden. It's not quite the same anymore. Like the screen has suddenly been filled with animated dancing penguins because Mary Poppins is teaching the children how to use their imaginations with sidewalk pictures. Or suddenly, all of a sudden, in the blink of an eye, the screen is filled with like it shifts into surreal, mythical, almost animation as Hermione tells the story, the tale of the Deathly Hallows. Or Iron Man, or Spider-Man, or Captain America, take your pick, it doesn't matter in the movies. They can be thinking about a memory. They can be thinking about a memory, reflecting on something that happened in the past, and then all of a sudden, like, images of that, like, fill the screen. All of a sudden, those things are, like, up on the screen. Usually, it comes with, like, some sort of change in lighting or the color palette changes or something like that. It maybe goes into sepia or black and white or something like that. Maybe it's cloudy around the edges. I don't know. All of us are familiar with this, is my point. All of us are familiar that we can be watching someone tell a story on the screen, and then all of a sudden we understand that a sudden shift can happen on the screen. The storyteller, the director, is trying to give us some sort of perspective, is what's happening. Some sort of perspective on maybe looking through the children's eyes at what these sidewalk pictures mean, or trying to give us some sort of perspective on what the Deathly Hallows mean, or some sort of perspective on what this means to Iron Man or Spider-Man or Captain America. Trying to help us know what that character is feeling, trying to remind us of the past, trying to somehow the storyteller's trying to shed new light on the story is what's going. We're all familiar with this, is my point. John of Patmos, in this strange book here at the end of the Bible, he doesn't have like the technology of film or fancy lighting or computer animation or anything like that, but what he does have is the technology of rhetoric. The technology of words is what he's got. In the first 11 chapters of Revelation, the story that John's been telling, the vision that John has been trying to communicate to his people, he's been captured by this vision and he's trying to communicate it to these churches. It's been trucking along in a very familiar way. We're quite familiar with it by now if we've been spending any time, we've been spending the last 8 or 9 weeks in it. John catches a glimpse of all-powerful, unstoppable Jesus in chapter 1. So he's going to write to the churches in chapters 2 and 3. And then he's swept backstage of all of reality in chapters 4 and 5, what we would call heaven. He's backstage of all of reality, where he sees God's top secret plan to save the world in the form of a scroll sealed with 7 seals. And that, of course, over the course of chapters 6 and 7, led to the breaking of all of these seals and then the unfolding of the scroll and God beginning to answer the prayers of his people in the trumpet blasts. He's beginning to answer all of the cries of God's people. And that landed us in chapter 10 last week, with the top secret, now opened plan of God being brought to John on a silver platter, as it were. I mean, like literally. An angel brings the revelation. It really is. It's the revelation of revelation. It is like the thing that's being revealed is brought to John. It's from Jesus. It's from the Lamb. Jesus has opened up something, and he's giving it to John in chapter 10 so that John can make it known. Lo and behold, that's actually exactly what John told us his book was going to be about in the opening lines. You can throw that first slide up, Bob. At the very beginning of Revelation, chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "The revelation from Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw." That is the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. It's like last week, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which was that he gave to an angel to give to John. We finally got there. It took halfway through the book, but we finally got there last week. And it's like that's where the real revealing of Revelation actually begins. It's like the real revelation of Revelation finally begins in earnest halfway through the book. We saw last week that God's plan to save the world, it's not meant to just be like read. It's not meant to be like examined, intellectually analyzed from a distance. That's not what the plan of God is meant to be. It's not meant to be any of that. God's plan, in the most bizarre of image that John borrowed from Ezekiel, God's plan is meant to be eaten. It's meant to be ingested. It's meant to be embodied, is what we saw last week. John symbolically acted this out in chapter 10 by eating the scroll, whatever that means. And then he immediately started telling a story that reinforced the point. He told us the parable of the two witnesses, that of what happens when two or three people who gather in Jesus' name start testifying to Jesus in the world. In a nutshell, he saw what happens when a community of people faithfully love, faithfully point to Jesus and embody his love to the point of death. That's what we saw in chapter 11. When a group of people, when two or three who are gathered in the name of Jesus, embody the love of God to the point of death, displayed for us on the cross. When a community of people embodies love to the point of death, it is more powerful than all the plagues of Egypt, is what seemed to be being said by the end of chapter 11. Sacrificial love and witness can do and accomplish what fear and judgment never could accomplish. Love to the point of death is the thing that changes people's lives, we saw in chapter 11. That's, I think, the revelation of Revelation. I think that's the challenge of Revelation too. You churches who are facing persecution, you Christians who are tempted to give up on Jesus, don't walk away from the faith. Don't abandon Jesus. Don't compromise with a world full of evil who would want to fill you with hatred. No. Embody love. Love to the point of death. Cling to Jesus, even when it's hard. Cling to Jesus, even when it's painful. The Lamb loves to the point of death, and that's what you're invited into as well. You're invited to participate in that love. And so that's actually where we are this week. We have to kind of tell the story again and again, because Revelation is telling a story. We're moving into chapter 12, that we've moved away from the parable of the church witnessing to the world for some sort of symbolic period of time in history, and we ended by hearing the seventh trumpet being sounded. We heard in chapter, it was actually in verse 15 of chapter 11, we heard the final trumpet sounding. It's like once the church follows Jesus in his love to the point of death, history ends. But that's kind of weird, because it's like the final judgment of God arrived in the middle of the book of Revelation. It's kind of strange. It's like, what exactly is the rest of this book about? You know what I mean? The seventh trumpet, the final trumpet sounded. The final trumpet, the final judgment arrived in chapter 11, but we still got like 11 chapters to go. Well, in a nutshell, The next few chapters of Revelation are basically John like circling back around and exploring the parable of the two witnesses, the role, the task of the church in the world a little bit more. He's circling back around and he's exploring it from kind of different angles. John's a master storyteller. He's like in the ranks of Scorsese or Spielberg or Walt Disney. He's very gifted. He's very good. Even if he's not writing the Bible, even if he's not recruited by the Spirit of God to write the Bible, he could still be telling epic, amazing stories. And as we enter into chapter 12 right here, John begins employing all of his storytelling skills in the service of God, the service of God's Spirit. Because what happens here in chapter 12 is it's like the color palette shifts. It's like the style and the lighting changes, and suddenly, well, we'll read it, but the best thing, maybe the best way to describe is it's something like surreal, mythical animation that is flooding the screen. So let's read it. Chapter 12, verse 1. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its heads. Its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. If that sounds familiar, it's because you've already heard it in chapter 11, verse 3, 1,260 days. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil, or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore, rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you, and he is filled with fury, because he knows that his time is short." When the dragon saw that he'd been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the 2 wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the wilderness, where she would be taken care of for a time, times and half a time, out of the serpent's reach. Then from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus. John's transition into chapter 12 is something like shifting from a live-action film into something like animation is the best way I can wrap my head around it. The language is like exaggerated. It's like cartoonish even. It's cartoonish. It's the language of symbol. We might even say, if we weren't scared of it, the language of myth is the language being used here. We're introduced, verses 1 and 2, to a dazzling woman, and then verses 3 and 4 to a terrifying dragon. We'll touch on his description. He shows up in chapter 13, so we'll talk about his heads and horns next week. And then, towards the end of the chapter, I kid you not, it really feels like something like a Roadrunner cartoon, right? You guys remember Roadrunner cartoons? Anyone remember? Wile E. Coyote, like, does everything he can to catch the Roadrunner. He's always getting some sort of box, opening it up. He's always hatching some sort of ingenious, diabolical scheme. But no matter how much he tries, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Everything, it seems like the laws of gravity, everything he pulls out of the box, everything in the universe is conspiring against Wile E. Coyote. The Roadrunner always gets away. That's what verses 13 through 16 sound like, right? The dragon tries to catch the woman, verse 13, but then she's given the wings of a great eagle, verse 14, and she flies to a safe place in the wilderness. The dragon, verse 15, he tries sweeping the woman away with like a flood of chaos and water that just flows out of his mouth. But then like a sinkhole opens, verse 16, and it just like absorbs all of the flood. It's a little funny. It's so exaggerated that it's a little comical. It's a bit like Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. It's like the laws of the universe. It's like even creation itself, even the earth itself, is working against the serpent, working against the dragon. Everything is on the side of the woman, this dazzling woman. There's like a cartoonish, dreamlike quality to the next few chapters. And then, just as a heads up, around chapter 15, we're going to see actually like these larger-than-life, cartoonish, animated characters, a dragon and a woman and monsters and beasts merge with the main story. It's a bit like the equivalent of like computer animation in mixing with live action. It's kind of what happens in Revelation. I think John, the master storyteller, I think he's trying, by doing this, telling the story, I think he's doing what all good storytellers do. I think he's trying to give us some sort of perspective. He's telling a story that we're all familiar with. It's the story of a child who's destined to destroy evil, and he's being threatened at birth. That's a popular story. The most popular version of it, modern example of it, is Harry Potter. It really is Harry Potter. Harry Potter is the chosen one destined to destroy the evil serpent-like Voldemort and protected by the powerful ancient magic of love until he's old enough to do it. The most ancient example of this story is probably the story of Apollo. All seven of John's churches in first century Asia Minor would have been familiar with this story. The goddess Leto was pregnant with Zeus's son, Apollo, who was destined to kill the great dragon Python. And so the great dragon Python attacks the goddess Leto, but Zeus carries her away on the wind, and Poseidon hides her on an underwater island for 4 days until Apollo is born, and then ready after 4 days to kill the dragon. Evidently, Apollo had like a very fast, one would think very painful, puberty. It's a popular story, this child destined to destroy evil. And John, it's a powerful, popular story. It's a symbolic story. It's full of symbolism. John tells us as much in verses 1 and 3. He says that the woman, verse 1, and the dragon, verse 3, they're signs. They're signs. These aren't literal. These are signs. They're symbols for something. For John's churches, familiar with the Old Testament, these symbols would evoke something of like the Garden of Eden, probably, like of Eve and the serpent, a woman and the serpent. The symbolism of the woman and the dragon, it stirs up like the earliest memories of the biblical witness, and it stirs up the earliest hopes of the biblical witness, too, that one day evil would be crushed. But there's one thing in the story that he says isn't symbolic. There's one thing that isn't a sign. It's not a sign for anything. It's actually the real deal. He says, verse 5, there's a male child born to rule the nations. And the male child, he's not a sign. He's not a symbol for anything. He's like literal. He's like literally the real deal. John's talking about a real person whom they knew. John's talking, he names him in verse 17. He's talking about Jesus. So John's shifted. He's made some sort of shift in his story, and he's telling one version, his own version, of like a popular story that we even know, that they all knew, but with one extraordinary difference. He says it's true. He says it's true. This is about Jesus. In the language of C.S. Lewis, in Jesus we find the myth that really happened. Really happened. It's like it's the real deal. John's retelling a popular story, but he's making it about a person that's still in living memory. Jesus only appears for a flash in this story in verse 5, and then he's snatched up. He's raptured is actually the word. It's the only time it shows up in Revelation. He's snatched up to heaven. It's like the entire life of Jesus. All four gospels fit neatly and squarely into verse 5. So really, if you want to think about it this way, what we have in Revelation 12 is the Christmas story. We have the Christmas story. It's just the Christmas story in like the strangest way that we've ever heard it told. Obviously, it's not like a literal telling of Jesus' story. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was not literally chased by a dragon through a desert after Jesus' birth. There's some parts of this that do represent or pointing to actual literal historical events, like Jesus being threatened before his birth by King Herod. But this is a highly symbolic, highly stylized telling of the story. It doesn't seem like the woman is Mary, mother of Jesus. It seems like this woman is something like the entire people of God. Is what it seems like, best we can tell. It's like daughter Zion in the Old Testament, like virgin Israel, like the bride of Yahweh. Those are ways that God talks about his people in the Old Testament. Suddenly, daughter Zion finds herself the mother of God in chapter 12. That's the great and sacred mystery, by the way, of the Christian faith, that God himself would choose to become human, that God himself would choose to become one of his own people. God did this, of course, through a literal woman named Mary, a literal virgin named Mary. Yeah, that's true enough. But if you really want to understand, if you really want it to sink in, if you really want the full weight, the full impact of what this means, if you want perspective on the coming of Jesus, on the story that really, truly, we are all still caught up in, we are still all living in, you have to tell the story like this, John seems to be saying. The arrival of Jesus has won a war. It's won a war, verses 7 through 12. The life, death, resurrection, ascension of Jesus. So the entire life of Jesus is packed into verse 5. You might say that with that, the armies of heaven, led by Michael from Daniel's visions back there in the Old Testament, have defeated the forces of evil. The enemy of life has been defeated. Life has won in the coming of Jesus. We call this enemy of life. We call him all sorts of things. Verse 9, we call him the dragon, the ancient serpent, the devil, the subpersonal hole, vacuum in the universe who leads the entire world astray. But the point of Jesus' story, of what the church clings to, is that the enemy of life has lost. He's lost. If you believe this for just like one second, if you get caught up in the story for just one second, it takes your breath away. such good news. Heaven has conquered hell. Heaven has won. God has written himself. This is a sacred mystery. God has written himself into the story. He's birthed himself into his own people, and he has defeated darkness from the inside. It's not that we deny the darkness. It's just that the darkness has been defeated. The dragon, verse 8, has lost his place. The forces of evil are defeated. I'm not sure at all that this story is trying to point us to exactly when this story happened, exactly when evil was defeated. I think what it's trying to say is that evil is defeated. That's the point. Whether or not it's at the cross, or whether sweeping tail swept down angels or something before time began, I don't know, genuinely. But the point of this story, I don't think, is when it happened. The $5 way of saying it would be, I think this story is less about chronology, about when it happened, and I think it's more about ontology, about that it has happened. It actually has happened. Let's not worry about the details of chronology. Let's all just rejoice that there's good news. The enemy of life is lost. The dragon has been hurled down, verses 7 through 9. Evil has been defeated. That's glorious news. But now, and this is our lives, the woman, verse 13, the people of God are on the run. All is not right yet. The woman is on the run. We're back to the Roadrunner cartoon. The dragon continues to chase the woman. But in some sort of ultimate sense, he cannot destroy her. Everything is on the side of the woman. The people of God are, seems like common in the Bible, the people of God are in the wilderness for some sort of symbolic period of time, but they're safe. They're safe. Safe from any kind of like ultimate harm. It's the, by the way, I mentioned it. It's the same symbolic time period that was given to us for the two witnesses witnessing to Jesus. That's because chapter 12 is a different way of looking at chapter 11. The people of God always seem to be spending time in the wilderness. They're, whether you describe it as witnessing to the world and somehow their love converting people over, or whether we focus on it from a different angle, the people of God being pursued and chased by evil. It seems like the people of God are always having to spend some sort of symbolic period of time in the wilderness before they get to inherit the promised land. But the chapter ends by saying that the woman's safe. The woman is safe. But her offspring, that's who the dragon's after now. We're told the dragon storms off to wage war against the woman's offspring, verse 17. We don't have to guess who the offspring are because it tells us, thankfully. It says that the church's children are individual Christians, those who keep God's commands and hold fast to their testimony about Jesus. The church, the people of God, are safe in some sort of ultimate sense, but individual communities in Pergamum or Smyrna or Laodicea, individual communities and individual Christians are still under fire. The dragon's after them. He can't defeat the woman, but he can devour maybe some of her offspring. The war is won. This is our lives. The war is won, but there's some sort of battles still being waged. The chapter leaves us kind of holding our breath a little bit. What's this going to look like? Despite the ultimate victory, the dragon's still waging war. Well, what exactly does this war look like? How does it manifest itself in the world? Well, that's where John's going to take us in chapter 13. So you'll have to wait until we get to chapter 13. But maybe today, as we come to the table this morning, maybe John's majestic, mythic, animated images that he holds before us, maybe they can give us some sort of perspective on our own lives. Perspective, you can go ahead and throw the only slide up, Bob. Perspective for when life is hard and when the battle feels lost. I think it's easy to feel confused. You know, I may be the only one, but maybe the only one in the room. But a lot of times when life is hard, life feels like you're in a fog, you don't know where you're going, you feel like you're lost, turned around blindfolded in the woods. You just feel, life is hard. Life is hard sometimes. Can we just get a witness there? It's not just that life feels hard. A lot of times we want to shy away from this. It's not just that life feels hard or that our circumstances look terrible. I think a lot of times we can shy away from admitting, Christians, evangelical Christians, we can shy away from admitting how hard life is, how hard life can be. Life is hard. It's not just seems hard. It is hard. Circumstances don't just look terrible sometimes. They are terrible. It genuinely is terrible. Jesus himself is like, John himself is writing this letter from an island prison. Likely he's having to deal with like isolation and feelings of helplessness. And as the people that he loves, think of names, faces, friends, children, they're facing an overwhelming river of lies being spewed out about them that's leading to like physical attacks, physical persecution. One of his friends, when John writes to the church of Pergamum, he hurts and he aches because one of his friends, Antipas, has recently died. Recently died for the sake of Jesus, chapter 2, verse 13. It's not just that life looks hard sometimes. Circumstances seem terrible sometimes. There's an enemy at work in the world. It actually is hard sometimes. Life is this unspeakable, beautiful, sacred gift. And life is legitimately, actually, frequently filled with evil. Life is hard sometimes. But for John, the life of Jesus grants him perspective. Perspective. When life is hard and the battle feels lost, Christians don't deny the dragon. We have a big place in our worldview for evil. We shouldn't be too quick to chalk up every hardship in our lives, every detail in our lives, or in other people's lives, every bit of suffering, every bit of circumstance, to the will of God. It's not all the will of God. Suffering is not God's will. He can use it. He does use it, thank God. But suffering is not God's will. Addiction is not God's will. War and hatred are not God's will. Anger and fear are not God's will. When you see those things at work in the world, when you see those things at work in your own life, you don't see the work of the Lamb. You see the work of the dragon. You see the work of the dragon. Christians don't deny the dragon, but we do deny the dragon's victory. The dragon has been defeated. God himself in the person of Jesus has defeated the dragon. Just his arrival, showing up, has won a war in heaven. So take heart, my brothers and sisters. Hear the story of Jesus and know this. Your life is part of something bigger than your hardship, than your circumstances. Your life is part of something bigger. You actually are living in a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale where dragons do exist, but you're also living in a fairy tale where the kingdom will live happily ever after. There's a day coming when anger and hatred and war and suffering, they're going to be just a memory, like a day coming for us, when those things are going to be just a memory. But until that day, the enemy of life he's flailing about and lashing out because, verse 12, he knows that he's running out of time. You have more time than evil does. Cling to Jesus. May the story of Jesus grant you perspective. May you cling to Jesus. Cling to him above all else and know that before you do, he clings to you. He clings to you. May your life embody his love to the point of death. Because that, verse 11, is the kind of life that the enemy cannot kill and cannot stop. And may God grant us the faith to trust that the war is won, that the dragon is dying, and that we are safe.